So I am doing a little short three-part refresher series on money and on giving. 5 years ago, as I said last week when I began, we did a full series, 4 weeks on money, you and money we called it, and 4 weeks on giving. And it's good from time to time to refresh that because it's a vital part not only of living in this world but of church life and of being a believer. Jesus had a lot to say about money. The rest of the New Testament adds a bit more. And I quoted the fact that I'd heard Rob say in Germany, Rob McFarlane, that he teaches on money once a year. And it's been 5 years, so I thought it's good. I also said that because of where our finances are as a church at the moment, and I chatted with Vince and Tony, and they had agreed this would be a good thing to do. I'm going to touch on that briefly now, but I'm going to leave most of that till 2 weeks' time when I'm back from Paris for our third and final morning. Because last Sunday morning, I just taught a one-off message on money. I called it Two Treasuries, Two Perspectives, and Two Masters. And I'm going to preach a one-off as a refresher on that subject. And today I'm going to preach a one-off message on giving, particularly on tithing, as a refresher on that subject. And 2 weeks' time when I come back, I think it would be good for us, just that you know, just to talk a little bit again about the church finances, how the money is collected, banked, accounted for, administrated, and what we spend it on, just that you can know those things, but also see where we're at as a church. But I do need to preface what I'm going to say this morning with this brief statement. It has been a year where our tithes have gone down quite significantly. I didn't actually bring the file with me, but as of the end of October, our tithes income per month, average tithes income per month for the first 10 months of the year is just short of £1,200 down per month. Times that by 10 months, we're talking over £10,000. And we are, in fact, I'm letting you know, this is not drama, this is not manipulation. I've taken up the offering before, okay? But right as of the end of October, our full expenditure for the year has exceeded our income already by £12,500. And nearly all of that there has been some added expenditure, but nearly all of that is because of that, the tithes going down by just over £1,000 per month on average this year. And so I know that some of that is because some of our tithers have left. I understand that. We're not a wealthy community, certainly by this nation's standards. We're not a large church, but we're not a wealthy community there. And there are only, as I kind of did a brief check through the community list, there are only about 30 of the adults, that's 18 up and upwards, about 30 of the adults on our community list currently who actually are full-time earners. And considering that, I think, you know, we've done very well. And none of what I've said last week or I'm going to say today or next in a fortnight's time is to in any way put a heavy on anyone, but particularly those who have been giving so generously over so many years. There are many people who are tithing and who've given well beyond that. And God knows who you are. I don't know who you are, and that's as it should be. And but there are rewards in heaven, as we saw last week. You're debiting your earthly account, but you're crediting your heavenly account. And not only through your giving, but certainly it includes your giving. If you weren't here last week, the message will explain that. And so I want to thank you. But I'm also aware that you know, it's 5 years since I've preached on tithing. And times have been tough with the recession. So I'm aware that there may be folk here who were tithing but have stopped tithing. There may be folk here who were tithing the full tithe, but are now only giving part of their tithe. And I think there are people who've come into the life of church who've perhaps never heard about tithing. And so I think it's good just to revisit that. Now, as with the topic I addressed last week, You and Money, the full series I did 5 years ago is still available, and I encourage you to listen to it. And I'm going to be able to touch on tithing today, but there's a lot more that could be said about tithing as well as the other areas of giving. And I encourage you to get those recordings and to listen to it. But that's what I want to speak about today. And for the second week running, I've taken my title out of a chapter in this book. This is a particularly good book on the subjects of money and giving. It's called Money, Possessions, and Eternity. and by Randy Alcorn. And I remember when this book first came out in 1988, the guy who was leading the church I was part of then did some teaching out of this book, and I dipped into it, and it really is an outstanding book. But some years ago, he brought out a revised edition, which is what this one is, and it is by far the best book on money matters that I've ever come across. It's not to say I agree with absolutely everything in it, but certainly 90% upwards, I think it's superb. And so I encourage you to get that book if you want to just find out more about where I'm coming from in these 2 weeks. Last time I taught on tithing, I also flagged up this book, which is an outstanding little book by R.T. Kendall, well known to many of us. It was first issued under the title Tithing. It's now issued under the title The Gift of Giving. And so my title is just taken, and the talk is taken from one of those chapters in Randy Alcorn's book. And I've called it Tithing, The Training Wheels of Giving. And Randy Alcorn takes a slightly different approach to the one I took 5 years ago. But I'm nevertheless very happy with it. I think at the end of the day, we come out to the same place. And I want to say a few things. Now, what I did last time in some detail, so I'm really not going to touch on it much this morning, is paint the picture of what happened with tithing in the nation of Israel in the Old Covenant. And as part of the laws of caring for the poor and caring for the work of the ministry and the Jubilee year, sabbatical year, and gleaning and gathering and all those kind of laws, there were the regulations about tithing, that the Israelites bought a tenth of everything that they received from the hand of the Lord and brought it to the temple in Jerusalem, although every third year it was gathered in towns around Israel. And I spoke a bit about that, but I also made mention of the fact that we see some of God's people, even before the Old Covenant came into operation, giving a tenth of everything they received or of everything they possessed. Abraham, when he defeated those kings in Genesis, I think it's chapter 13, it says when he came back and he met with Melchizedek, and it said he gave him a tenth of all of his plunder from the battle. Jacob, many years later, was fleeing from his brother whom he had tricked, and God meets with him at Bethel with a ladder going up and down. You remember the story, angels going up and down on the ladder, and Jacob wakes up and says, oh, God was in this place, I didn't realize it. But and then he kind of makes a bargain with God because he is a real schemer, and he says, well, if you bring me back from where I'm going now safely, and then you'll be my God, and I'll give you a 10%. I'll give you a tithe of everything. It was something that somewhere way back in the past, how it was spoken to Abraham or even before that, we don't know. But God's people had something, some principle of tithing, of giving to God the first fruits before we even get to the Old Covenant. So I just want to pick up now with Jesus, with the early church, and some questions about tithing, and then some guidelines for us, if we are, or indeed if we're not, tithing, under this title, Tithing, the Training Wheels of Giving. Jesus grew up in a devout Jewish home. He had devout Jewish parents, and so they would certainly have tithed, and they would have instructed him to tithe, as did his Bible, which for him was the Old Testament. It would have instructed him to tithe. It's interesting that during his earthly ministry, he was carefully scrutinized by all his enemies, but of every possible offense. And if they saw him breaking one of their laws, they climbed in, like with the Sabbath, because he was teaching us something about the Sabbath, that the Sabbath was made for man and not the other way around. But it's interesting that he was never accused of not tithing. Moreover, the Talmud, body of Jewish laws, which expanded in the Old Testament, forbade any strict keeper of the law from sitting down to dine with someone who did not tithe. And yet many Pharisees were happy during the course of Jesus' ministry to sit down and dine with them. They must have been satisfied on that score. He also said that while the Pharisees should have paid attention to more important matters like justice and mercy, they were correct in being careful to tithe. And with this emphasis on sacrificial giving that Jesus often makes, he never once suggests that the floor, if you like, the foundational level of giving that is set in the Old Testament, he never once suggests that that foundation level is invalid. He simply raises the ceiling of giving to go far beyond it. When he exhorts his disciples to go the second mile in anything, he is surely assuming that they've already gone the first. Then we get after Jesus ascended and we have the church comes into existence. Of course, in the early days, Jewish Christians would have made up a strong proportion of the church. And they would have continued with something they had always been taught to do and felt was right to do. And they would have now brought their tithes as well as other offerings to their local assembly. And having been transformed, as we assume they were, by the grace of Jesus, we're sure their offerings increased. But there is no suggestion that they decreased. There's no suggestion that the early church ever retreated from believing that the tithe was a starting point in our giving. And in fact, I wasn't going to, but I'd like to just read three quotes that Mr. Elkhorn makes here from leaders in the early church. We call them the church fathers. They were sort of significant leaders in the church in the second, third, fourth, and even the fifth centuries. And it's interesting, some of the things they wrote. Here's Irenaeus, okay, about 200 years after Jesus. And it says here, the Jews were constrained to a regular payment of tithes. Christians who have liberty assign all their possessions to the Lord, bestowing freely not the lesser portions of their property, i.e. the tithe, a small proportion of it, bestowing not the lesser portions of their property, since they have the hope of greater things. A few hundred years later, we have Augustine, another famous church father, and he indicated that tithing was still being practiced by the church. Tithes are required as a matter of debt, and he who has been unwilling to give them has been guilty of robbery. Whosoever therefore desires to secure a reward for himself, let him render tithes, and out of the nine parts, let him seek to give alms. Pattern which was continuing. This is now 400 years or more after Jesus, and this was still something the church did, this pattern of giving tithes and then of voluntary offerings over and above that. Jerome, who was roughly contemporary with Augustine, another church father, said, if anyone shall not do this, that is pay tithes, he is convicted of defrauding and supplanting God. And so it's clear that tithing was a common practice in the church for at least 400 or 500 years, and possibly longer, but those are just the quotes I'm drawing from, after Christ. So the question then is often asked, so is tithing something that Christians still do today or should do today? I did address this question, obviously, in the full series I did on giving 5 years ago, and please go and listen to that. I'm trying very hard not to just repeat in any of that material, but just bring some fresh perspectives on it. And my conviction is that it is. Okay, that's what I've preached. That's what we've practiced. And let me go about it in saying this in a number of various ways. We need to understand that some laws from an old code of law can find their way into a new code. The fact that a code of law changes, such as happened in South Africa all those years back when the change from a minority white government to universal suffrage or democracy, it didn't mean that all the laws went out the window. All the unjust and racially discriminating laws went out the window, but a lot of the old laws in the old code found their way into the new code. And there are many examples in Scripture where this is actually affirmed, and there's many other examples where it's implied. So the old covenant, for example, said, you love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul. We know that Jesus affirmed that. We don't say we don't have to love God anymore because that's the law. The old covenant said, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus affirmed that. And the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. We don't stop doing that. Okay? When in Leviticus 9 or 10 times it says, be holy because I am holy, we know that Peter quotes that in 1 Peter. It says, live in holiness because as it is written, be holy as I am holy. So some laws from the old code find their way into the new code. And they are overtly affirmed. Others are implied. And have ongoing value for us. They're not laws that we have to fulfill in order to be righteous. We're made righteous through our faith in Christ. But they are things that we can follow or observe as we live out our righteousness. And many of the old covenant laws and regulations are helpful as patterns or as models for us, as principles or guidelines. So being under grace doesn't mean that we stop doing everything that we did when we were under law. and continuing to do some of the things like loving God, loving your neighbor, and being holy that we did when we were under the law, continuing to do them now isn't in any way contradictory to being under grace. Do you understand that? The grace law thing is about how we're justified, how we are made righteous or declared righteous in God's sight. And clearly it's not through fulfilling the law. So let me take an everyday example. There was a time where wearing seatbelts wasn't legally required. Then it became a law. It's possible, I know it's not probable, it's possible that it might one day no longer be legally required. You wouldn't then say to your children, you know, throw off that seatbelt. It's no longer law. You're not under law. Get rid of the seatbelt. It's still a sensible thing to do. It's still a helpful thing to do, even if it's not legally required. And I think tithing can be understood in that regard. Tithing is nowhere specifically rescinded in the New Testament. Not like the sacrifices, which were there to bridge the gap between God and us because of sin. We know Jesus has done that. He's fulfilled that. They are specifically rescinded, particularly in the book of Hebrews. You don't find that with tithing. And so, although Jesus fulfilled the entire Old Testament, he doesn't render it irrelevant. The regulations about how to love your neighbor in the book of Leviticus, they don't necessarily apply, but the command to love your neighbor still does, and the principles contained in those regulations can still be helpful for us as we continue to love our neighbors. It's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. The baby is ongoing principles intended for everyone. The bathwater are detailed regulations intended only for ancient Israel. Jesus affirmed it. The early church fathers taught it. The early church practiced it. And so I think the burden of proof is on those who say that we shouldn't tithe, that it's no longer a minimum standard of giving for God's people. Some people say, well, you know, they had to tithe in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, the only thing that's advocated is voluntary giving. Well, that was also advocated in the Old Testament. There was a minimum tithe, and it advocated voluntary giving. The fact that there is, you know, one doesn't exclude the other. If they could coexist in the old covenant, why can they not coexist under the new covenant? Being under grace doesn't mean that we live by lower standards than the law. Jesus made it clear that his standards were much higher than those required by the law. All the way through the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, from verse 17 onwards, it says, it is written, or you've heard it said, but I say to you. And he raised the standard with regard to murder, adultery, and many other things. And so, and he said, be perfect as your heavenly Father. You know, it's not new covenant. Grace does not mean that we live at a standard lower than the law. He actually raised the standard, but his grace empowers us to begin to live it. That's the difference. In the book of Acts, it says in Acts chapter 4, verse 33, in that passage, in Acts chapter 4, there's a little picture of the early church and their incredible generosity and how, you know, amongst all the other things they did, they gave and sold all everything that they had and shared it with those who were in need. And what is the explanation that is given for why and how they did that? It says in verse 33, for much grace was upon them all. They're giving to each other so radically, way beyond tithing. It wasn't law, it was grace. Much grace was upon them all. And because of that grace, they gave. Far beyond that minimum in the Old Covenant. But there's no suggestion that they ever thought that grace gave them license to give way below that standard of the Old Covenant. Being under grace didn't mean that these new covenant Christians gave less than their Old Covenant brethren. On the contrary, they gave much more. And all giving is, in the lovely phrase that Randy Alcorn uses, all giving really is reciprocating God's grace. Whether it's a tithe or any other kind of giving, it's reciprocating God's grace. Every example in the New Testament of giving goes beyond the tithe. None fall short of it. And so I do believe that tithing is something which we as Christians practice today, not as an ending point, but as a starting point. Some will still oppose tithing as legalism and say, well, you know, we've been set free, we're not under law, we live in grace, and we must just give, you know, as grace prompts us. That sounds good, but what does it often mean? Now, I know that Randy Alcorn is a North American, and he gives figures that are more apposite to North America, but some of his statistics there are actually quite shocking about how little most Christians actually give. And he also demonstrates that the wealthier America has got, the less the average Christian has given. So what does this sort of, well, let's throw off the law and let's just give as we move. What does it actually look like in practice? He says, even if we just take 10% as the minimum that Israelites gave, and he works out a percentage, you need to go and read his book, but he works out a percentage that with all the various kinds of giving that were exhorted, Israelites regularly gave up to 23% of their income. Currently, in North America anyway, and I can't think that it's that much different in our nation, he says the average American Christian gives 2.5%. He says this statistic suggests that law was about 10 times more effective than grace. 23% they gave in the Old Covenant, the average Israelite 2.5% and the average American today. Even if we just take the 10% as a measure, let's say they only gave 10% and didn't give beyond that, the Israelites were about four times more responsive to the law of Moses than the average American Christian is to the grace of Christ. And then he says, reread that last sentence and ask yourself if something isn't terribly wrong. When we as New Testament believers, living in a far more affluent society than ancient Israel, give only a fraction of that given by the poorest Old Testament believers, we must surely reevaluate our concept of, or stop hiding behind this concept of, well, we live in grace, just give, you know, what you feel like, what you want to. When you consider we have the indwelling spirit, that, and they didn't, the contrast becomes even more glaring. I found that to many people, the term grace giving simply means give whatever you feel like. And obviously, judging from the stats, most people just don't feel like giving. The assumption seems to be that God no longer expects his people to give substantially. But surely there is a timeless truth, and I totally agree with him. There is a timeless truth behind the concept of giving God the first fruits. It's so basic to biblical thinking. I don't think you can just reject that as being something that was under the law. It predates the law. It postdates the law. The law just administrated in a certain way. This idea of first fruits, that everything we have comes from God. And in recognition of that, we give him back the first fruits of what he's given us, what he's provided for us. Whether or not the tithe is still the minimum measure of those first fruits, we do have to ask ourselves, does God expect his new covenant children to give less than his old covenant children, the same or more? The tithe can be a tutor that leads us to true giving. He says, if we can learn to give 10% or more without tithing, fine. But the giving track record of Christians, contemporary Christians, clearly indicates that we have not learned to give. In fact, we've learned not to give. And our giving has declined as our prosperity has increased. The tithe is God's historical method to get people on the path of giving. In that sense, it can serve as a gateway to the joy of true grace giving today, just as it gave rise to spontaneous, joyful, free will giving in many passages in the Old Testament. It's unhealthy to view tithing as a place to stop with our giving, but it can still be a good place to start. It's not the finish line, but it is a starting line. Can tithing be legalistic? Of course. But so can prayer, Bible reading, and church attendance. But that doesn't make them illegitimate. You don't stop doing those things for fear of being legalistic. You just change the way in which you're doing them. He says, I will listen to any Christian who says tithing isn't meant for us today, provided that he or she himself gives beyond the tithe. But I've learned that there's often a hidden agenda behind the protest. I found that most people who argue against tithing use their arguments to justify their own lack of generous giving. I gently suggest that their reasons are less theological than personal. They simply don't want to give that much. The pro-grace or anti-legalism trump card rings hollow when it attempts to justify wealthy Christians giving less than the poorest Israelite. While appearing to take the theological high ground, it effectively says God has lowered his standards of giving and that the power of the New Testament grace is less than the power of the Old Testament law. Surely an insult to the saving and empowering work of Jesus and the Spirit. We tend naturally to embrace arguments that serve our perceived self-interest. Our substandard giving suggests we have ulterior motives for adopting an anti-tithing theology. Possibly where our treasure isn't is showing where our heart isn't. We must examine our hearts to discover whether, when we say tithing isn't for today, we are using grace as a license to clutch tighter to material wealth. So test me, he tells here, in the space of a paragraph of some friends of his, and I just wanted to read it. Some friends of ours as young Christians believed they were supposed to tithe. They did so faithfully, not legalistically, and God used tithing to remind them to put him first. That's one of the things that tithing does. Like the discipline of a regular quiet time, the discipline of tithing moved their thoughts towards God. I love that phrase. However, when they started attending another church, they heard from the pulpit that tithing is legalism and God has called us to grace giving. Unfortunately, the pastor did not suggest any starting place or guidelines for grace giving. As a result of this teaching, our newly liberated friends reduced their giving. Within a few years, they were giving almost nothing. Meanwhile, they floundered in their walk with God and incurred more and more debt. Finally, in a different church, they were reintroduced to the concept of tithing, not as a legalistic ritual, but as a simple starting place for giving. When they committed themselves to tithing again, they sensed God's blessing and experienced a peace they hadn't known for years. They attribute their several years of spiritual wandering directly to this high-sounding but misleading concept of grace giving. So, as I'm beginning to draw to a close, what are some of the values? What is the value or some of the benefits of tithing? And I think I've already implied some of them, but perhaps just to list them again. A little bit more systematically. Tithing is where God began with his old covenant people, and I think it's a fine beginning for his new covenant people. It says in Deuteronomy 14, verse 23, that tithing's purpose is that you may learn to revere the Lord your God. There was a spiritual purpose behind this very material sacrifice, that you may learn to revere the Lord your God. It's intended to train us to put God first. That's what tithing does. I think some of the lines in that test me said that. The 10% reminds us of the other 90%. And in that sense, the tithe symbolizes the giving of our whole life. God knows we need that some of that money to live on. And he allows us to keep it. But in some ways, in bringing the tithe, we are symbolizing the giving of our whole life to God. The 10% represents the 90%. The tithe gives us perspective. It reminds us that all we have and all we are is from God. It's just an expression of dependence on and gratitude to the God who has provided. When we don't give it, it's like we're saying our dependence is on the money. But when you give some of that money away, especially if it's difficult to do that, what are you saying? You're saying, Lord, I'm depending on you. But you're also saying, I don't think this has happened by chance. I'm grateful to you for giving what you've given to me. And the other thing about tithing is it requires calculation, doesn't it? You have to add up all your sources of income because you tithe on everything that God gives you. Your salary, benefits, dividends, interest, gifts, I don't know, whatever other kind of money you may receive. But that's all God's provision. And so it requires calculation. You have to add all of that up. And so what are you doing? You're literally counting your blessings. You can't tithe without counting your blessings and seeing God's goodness and generosity. Parting with money wasn't any easier for the people of Israel than for us. Most of them were far poorer and, say this gently, possibly than some of us worked a lot harder for their money than we do. That might not be true of everyone, but it might be for some. It was a divine invitation to test God's promise to provide. That's what the tithe was. We know that from Malachi chapter 3. Go and read Malachi chapter 3, verses 8 to 12. But verse 10 says, test me in this and see if I don't prove myself that in this regard, that bring your whole tithe into the storehouse and I will pour out blessing on you. It is an invitation as we give the tithe to trust God to provide. It can begin as a duty, but it can become a delight. And it frees us up to further joyful, voluntary giving. There are practical arguments for tithing, not just the biblical ones. It's a clear and consistent principle. It's easy to work with, and it's easily transferable. In other words, it can be easily taught to new believers or to our children. It's not something that's, you know, as we grow on in maturity, we can hear God about giving that's beyond that, where there's no measurement to it. But the tithe is something that's easily grasped and easily taught. It increases the believer's sense of commitment to God's work. When we're giving substantially like that, it's like we have a stake in the thing we're giving to. It increases our sense of commitment in that thing. Tithing can be a significant factor in spiritual growth. Many people testify that the tithe was the start of a spiritual breakthrough in their lives. Not a material breakthrough, although it can be that too. But one leader said this, I'm just quoting a leader, said, the second most important gift of grace I have received after salvation, he means, has been the discipline of tithing. The Lord got my heart when I began to tithe. It can be a significant factor in spiritual growth, and it can be a significant factor in our giving growth. Those who give super generously and sacrificially, way beyond the tithe, for them that lifestyle is often started with the tithe. That's what launched them into a lifestyle of giving. And lastly, under the benefits and the value of tithing, we have to simply say this. If all Christians practice tithing, the task of evangelizing the lost and feeding the hungry would surely be within reach. It's interesting, and Randy Alcorn cites the Southern Baptists. And, you know, the Southern Baptists get knocked for a lot of things. But isn't it interesting that they preach and practice tithing, and they also have, or possibly the denomination anywhere in the world that has more impact in world missions? They support over 5,000 full-time missionaries, I think it is, in 153 different countries. And they're able to do that because, and they're able to resource that because of their convictions about tithing. One more final look at four common arguments against tithing. Then I want to give you four pitfalls to avoid if you are tithing. Tithing is legalism. Any legitimate practice can be done with a legalistic attitude. In such case, the fault lies with the attitude of our heart, not with the practice itself. If anything hits too close to home or starts meddling with our life, the life we want to live, it is all too easy for us to dismiss it as legalistic. Legalism can be a convenient label to cover our unwillingness to obey God. And we just need to watch for that one. I must pay with my debts rather than tithe. We have to ask ourselves, that would be another argument against tithing. Surely I must pay with my debts. We have to ask ourselves, why am I in debt in the first place? Is God responsible for some of my unwise and possibly greedy decisions that put me there? And even if I'm in debt through no fault of my own, if such a scenario is possible, isn't my first debt to God? If we obey God and make good our debt to Him, because the tithe belongs to Him, He'll help us as we seek to pay off our debts to others. But I must not rob God to pay men. Third objection to tithing, I'm going to tithe eventually, but I need to move towards it slowly. That's like the bank robber who says, I know it's wrong to rob 10 banks a year as I have been doing, so next year I'll cut down to 8, and the year after that to 6. It's just not the right solution, is it? The right solution is just to stop robbing banks, and the right solution is to start tithing. And the solution to robbing God is not to start robbing Him less, but to stop robbing Him at all. And that leads me to the fourth and final objection we sometimes make against tithing. I just can't afford to tithe. And Randy Alcorn's response is simply, of course I can. If tithing is God's will, and He promises to provide for those who trust and obey Him, won't He allow me to get by on the 90% rather than the 100%? In fact, aren't I a lot safer living on less inside God's will than on living than if I live on more outside of it. Many Christians testify that they live just as easy on the 90% as the 100%. Many others testify that their financial problems began when they withheld the tithe, not when they tithed. If tithing is God's minimum expectation, can I afford not to tithe? Many can't afford to tithe precisely because they're not giving in the first place. And that principle that we see in Haggai and Malachi, and even in Luke, I think, you know, where Haggai says, you know, you're doing all this work and you're doing all this farming and building, but it's like there's holes in your pockets and the grain's running out all the time. And there's a similar thing in Malachi, and that's when God says, okay, you know, you have nothing because you're robbing me, but bring the tithe and see if I don't bless you. And we will be able to afford. It seems it's a paradox. But when we give to God what belongs to him, and even though we'll have less, we will afford to tithe. In Luke 6, verse 38, Jesus says, give, and it will be given to you. Pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For whatever measure you use, it will be used towards you. 6:38. If we pay our debt to God first, then we receive his blessing to help us pay our debts to men. But when we rob God to pay men, we rob ourselves of God's blessing and thereby dig a deeper hole. It's a vicious cycle, and it takes obedient faith to break out of it. But speak to brothers and sisters, even here, and they'll tell you they took that step of obedient faith, and God provided for them and enabled them to not only do it, but to keep on doing it. Some people sincerely believe that if they made more money, they would start tithing. But as the statistics show, the richer someone becomes, the less likely it is they will tithe. If you can't tithe when you're earning as a new kid straight out of school, working at Primark or wherever you're working, if you can't tithe on £100 that you get paid in the week, don't think you're going to be able to tithe when you make it big, sign for Liverpool and get paid £10,000 a week. It's going to be very, very unlikely. It's not impossible, but it's very unlikely. That's why I think as children we should be taught to tithe. And so as our income grows, our tithing, it's just something ingrained in us, 10%. It's not like God is requiring a fixed amount from everybody. That would just be unfair. It's a proportion. It's the same proportion for everyone, and it's a small proportion. Some believe that their poverty exempts them from tithing, yet by global standards, most of these people are easily in the top 10% of the world's wealthy. So we can afford to tithe. Four pitfalls to avoid if you do tithe. So I'm speaking to many of you here. Do not see it, firstly, as an unwanted tax or bill. Like you do it, you pay the tithe, you bring the tithe, and it kind of clears your conscience. So you're able to live more comfortably with yourself. If we bring our tithe as an unwanted tax or bill, it will totally rob us of the joy of giving it. It's worship. It's an offering to God. Recognition of dependence, expression of gratitude, all this kind of stuff that I've said. Second thing is pitfall to avoid. Don't see it as a membership due. Like if you belong to a club, you've got to pay your dues. You belong to the church, you've got to pay your tithe. Because although we preach tithing and we believe in it and we exhort you to practice it, I don't know who's tithing and who isn't. I'll never know. So it's not dues. You can actually be part of this church, the community of this church, and not tithe. So there's no membership dues. But I don't think it's good for you, and I don't think it's actually good for us. Third thing, a very important pitfall we must avoid if we are tithing. Don't be proud about it. The tithe can become an idol to set on a pedestal and admire. We have to catch ourselves doing that. Oh, I've tithed. Got this big payment in and I tithe. And we kind of put it on a pedestal and we admire. Look at the tithe I paid. Be careful of pride. I'm one of the faithful few who really trust and obey God. Unlike the non-tithing apostates. And perhaps the most subtle of all, the fourth pitfall we must avoid if we're tithing, is don't get complacent at that level of giving. It's dangerously tempting to make a tithing once you're doing it, And perhaps you've battled to do it. It's taken you years to get to do it. But it's dangerously tempting, once you're doing it, to make it your resting place, your final resting place. To view it as a lofty summit rather than simply as the starting point. Let's not be proud. Let's not be complacent. So in conclusion, without guideposts, where do you start giving? Why not start where God started with Israel, with the tithe? Tithing is a child's first steps. Not his last, nor his best, but a fine beginning. It's his first step, our first step of stewardship. Tithing is, in the words of my title, the training wheels on the bicycle of giving. It's not a home run, but it gets you to first base. If you still insist that tithing has no bearing on Christians, add up all your pre-tax income from every source, and add up all your giving. If you discover that you have been regularly giving more than 10%, then you're right. You don't need to tithe any more than you need training wheels on your bike. Just go on doing what you are doing and let God move you on in free will giving. But if you're giving 7% or 5% or 3% or 1%, it shows that perhaps we do need those training wheels to get us up on the bike of giving. If you fear legalism, fine, don't start at 10%, start at 11 or 12%. Choose your own percentage, but don't go below a standard that you believe was superseded by the superior grace of Christ. For surely the law cannot be more effective than the grace. Begin with the tithe. It shows you're serious, and as you continue to tithe, you'll sense God's approval, his pleasure, his provision, his blessing, his protection, and you'll experience that freedom that comes and that joy that comes from knowing that you've made Jesus Lord, not only of your life, but of your wallet, of your money and your possessions. Your pocketbook has got baptized too. Tithing isn't the end of giving, but it is a good beginning. So let's pray together. Father, my prayer has been this week and this morning that you will take my words and you will speak to me and to each of us the words which, by way of challenge and exhortation and encouragement and excitement, you want to speak to us. I pray for my hearers' sake, for their freedom, for their joy, for their obedience, for their blessing and protection. I pray that you will bring us into a life of generous giving, which starts with and then goes beyond the tithe. I pray for our sakes as a church, Lord, just because of our financial needs and the things that we are doing, but even more, the things you want us to do. Lord, I pray that we will also hear this message, that both through the provision that comes in through our tithing, but also that added provision that comes in through your blessing because we're tithing. I pray for our sakes as a church also, Lord, that you will take this message and you will speak to our hearts. Pray that you will convict us by your Spirit, but you will also draw us and woo us into something that is actually, while it seems impossible for some, not nice for others, just difficult for yet others. But still, Lord, it's a life of obedient and generous and sacrificial giving, which ultimately is very exciting, very free, very happy. And I pray that you will school us in that by your Spirit, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen.